The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
All right. Welcome to a Monday, everyone. I'd say happy Monday, but it's not really a happy occasion, though it should be, right? I mean, look back after 20 years in Afghanistan. We're out of there, right? That should be it. What more do we need? Well, except things there are not good. There's that old saying, you break it, you buy it. Well, we didn't break Afghanistan. Let's put it that way. Afghanistan was broken before we got there. We just, you know, overstayed our welcome. Not that we were ever welcomed, but we should have gotten out of there. Well, we should have never gone in, but that's, you know, that's another story. We can't totally rewrite history. We did go in and we stayed for 20 years. 20 years. That's insane, right? That's too much. So, I want to take us back. We've got a great show for you today. I wish I could take credit for the booking genius for today, because Spencer Ackerman is our guest. Spencer Ackerman has been covering, you know, issues of national security for his entire career, and he just released a new book. It was out a week ago tomorrow, so 6 days ago. It's called Reign of Terror, How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump. If I could have chosen who I would like to talk to today, I think Spencer Ackerman, given this, the release of this book, was at the top of the list. I made the mistake of saying it was fortuitous timing, and someone said, you know, given the events, that doesn't sound too good. I don't mean to, dance on anyone's grave or make light of a really bad situation, but it was fortuitous timing on the booking. Today just happens to be the day they gave me when I said, yes, I want to interview Spencer Ackerman. So they said, how does Monday, August 16th look? And I said, it's in the book. We're live. He'll be with us live at the bottom of the hour. So we have not spoken yet. On some days I do pre-record the interviews. Today I did not. He will be calling, or we'll be calling him. It'll be a phoner at the bottom of the hour. So before we get there, I want to take you back and give you a little bit of historical context. So we are coming up on the 20th anniversary, you know this, of 9/11. Yeah, the day we were attacked. And guess what? Afghanistan did not attack us. Mm-mm. Nor did the Taliban. Nope, the Taliban did not attack us. You know who attacked us? It was Al-Qaeda. It was Al-Qaeda. And the reports we had were that Al-Qaeda was based and they did the planning in Afghanistan. And that's why we went to Afghanistan? That's why we attacked Afghanistan? You see, so much of it just never made sense. It didn't then, and it doesn't now, to be honest. But here we are. And just a few days after the 9/11 attacks, Congress decided, well, we're going to go into Afghanistan. And out of, the usual number of representatives in the House of Representatives is 435, right? So say there were 435 members of the House on September 14th, 2001. Could have been down a couple. I'm not sure. That's why I'm qualifying it. The only one member of Congress stood up and said, no, we do not go in to attack Afghanistan because of this. And so I think on a day like today, we do need to take 2 minutes, 2 minutes and 4 seconds, actually, and salute Barbara Lee, because she was the only one who stood up and did the right thing. September 14th, 2001.
Gentlewoman from California is recognized for a minute and a half.
Hold on.
Thank you. And I want to thank my ranking member and my friend.
Hold on.
Yielding.
I got to.
Mr. Speaker, members, I rise today here, really with audio. A very heavy heart. one that is filled with sorrow for the families and the loved ones who were killed and injured this week. Only the most foolish and the most callous would not understand the grief that has really gripped our people and millions across the world. This unspeakable act on the United States has really forced me, however, to rely on my moral compass, my conscience, and my God for direction. September 11th changed the world. Our deepest fears now haunt us. Yet I am convinced that military action will not prevent further acts of international terrorism against the United States. This is a very complex and complicated matter. Now, this resolution will pass, although we all know that the president can wage a war even without it. However difficult this vote may be, some of us must urge the use of restraint. Our country is in a state of mourning.
Yes.
Some of us must say, let's step back for a moment. Let's just pause just for a minute and think through the implications of our actions today so that this does not spiral out of control. Now, I have agonized over this vote, but I came to grips with it today, and I came to grips with opposing this resolution during the very painful yet very beautiful memorial service. As a member of the clergy so eloquently said, as we act, let us not become the evil that we deplore. Thank you, and I yield the balance of my time.
Okay,
so
that is Barbara Lee. That was on September 14th, 2001. Now, in the chat room, my husband just needs to get his two cents in. Hello, David Sloan. What's up?
Hi, this is David calling from Coral Springs, an angry white man.
Yes.
And I would like to, in regard to Afghanistan, I would like to quote one of the immortals.
Yeah.
Rufus T. Firefly, as played by Groucho Marx in the movie Duck Soup.
Okay.
When he said, "Remember, men, we're fighting for this woman's honor, which is probably more than she ever did."
Huh.
That is exactly the situation in Afghanistan. We fought harder, we bled more, we paid a higher price for their freedom than they ever cared to give. We owe those people nothing.
Okay.
Yes, we should certainly get the people who helped us out of there as quickly and as safely as possible. But beyond that, the only thing we need to show them is our back.
Okay.
I love you, Madeline.
All right. I love you too. Thank you, David. So that's my husband's opinion. I'm not quite as cut and dry as he is. And we're going to get into it. I listened to President Biden's speech a moment ago. I agree with most of what he said. Let me say this right up front. I'm glad we're out of Afghanistan. I think, like Barbara Lee, we never should have gone in the first place. I hate to say we overstayed our welcome because we were never welcome there. While many of the innocent people of Afghanistan wanted us there, the people in power did not. And the people who could have, in 20 years, taken the $80 billion worth of equipment and training to build their military, and they would have run with it. They would have done it. They would not have collapsed in the face of the Taliban within days of the United States leaving. Just it wouldn't have happened. So the people at Now This News put together a nice little compilation, just 3 minutes long, that gives you a timeline from July, when President Biden was so wrong on his outlook of what would happen in Afghanistan if we left, to now. Here's your timeline. All right, we got a lot of ground, a lot of territory to cover in the next 20 minutes. So, here's now this, starting with Joe Biden.
Mr. President, thank you very much. Your own intelligence community has assessed that the Afghan government will likely collapse.
That is not true.
That is not true.
Can you please clarify what they have told you about whether that will happen or not?
That is not true. They did not reach that conclusion.
So what is the level of confidence that they have that it will not collapse?
The Afghan government and leadership has to come together.
Okay.
They clearly have the capacity to sustain the government in place.
Yeah.
The question is, will they generate the kind of cohesion to do it?
Huh.
It's not a question of whether they have the capacity. They have the capacity. They have the forces. They have the equipment.
Well, he got
the question
that right.
Is, will they do it?
How serious was the corruption among the Afghanistan government to this mission failing there?
Well, first of all, the mission hasn't failed.
Okay.
Yet.
Again, this was July
8th. It is in Afghanistan. And all parties, there's been corruption. The question is, can there be an agreement on unity of purpose? What is the objective? For example, it started off, there were going to be negotiations between the Taliban and the Afghan National Security Forces and the Afghan government. That didn't come to fruition. So the question now is, where do they go from here? That the jury is still out. But the likelihood there's going to be the Taliban overrunning everything and owning the whole country is highly unlikely.
I don't think it's going to be something that happens from a Friday to a Monday.
Okay, this is Anthony Blinken. This is the new Secretary of State. Now, while Joe Biden made sense, obviously he was wrong, but he made sense, listen to what Blinken said.
I don't think it's going to be something that happens from a Friday to a Monday. So I wouldn't necessarily equate the departure of our forces in July, August, or by early September with some kind of immediate deterioration.
Yet that's exactly what happened. This was in June. Tony Blinken said that. Talk about being wrong. I mean, dead wrong.
In the situation.
The administration's view has been the Afghan forces have what they need. They've got the equipment, they've got the forces to fight back. But the Taliban now controls about 60% of the territory in Afghanistan. Isn't
this
it clear
was 2 weeks
Afghans
ago?
At this point, don't really have control.
Well, I think our point here is, Stephanie, is that we will continue to provide close air support, making sure that Air Force functions are operable. We will continue to resupply their forces with food
All
and
right.
equipment.
I'm going to stop this now because you get the idea. So it's Jen Psaki basically backing up what Joe Biden said, what Tony Blinken said. They didn't expect it was going to get to this point. Obviously, Joe Biden said that will not happen. He was wrong. Anthony Blinken said it won't happen from a Friday to a Monday. Yeah, you're sure about that? Because that's exactly what happened. So the footage from the airport from the weekend is horrific. I'm not going to play for you the footage of that big transport jet taking off with people just trying to climb up the ladder to get on the plane. There were Afghan citizens, obviously, who are so fearful for their lives from, you know, what the Taliban could do to them, that they held on to the outside of the jet as it took off. And you see the jet taking off in the air and bodies falling off the side of the plane. These are desperate people. And you understand why. The Taliban, they're bad guys. But let's remember, we did not go into Afghanistan to fight the Taliban, although I've heard people say that this week. No, what we did was we went into Afghanistan to stop Al-Qaeda from launching another terrorist attack. From there, I think the whole thing was misguided. I do agree with David, my husband, in that we really don't owe them anything. I mean, we spent $80 billion to build their military, to train them, to outfit them. We built their infrastructure. We built schools and a police. I mean, Afghanistan was a broken shell of a nation before we got there, because remember, Soviet Union had invaded Afghanistan before us. And that's why they call it the Graveyard of Empires. It was certainly a part of the end of the Soviet Union. And I think, frankly, Osama bin Laden got exactly what he wanted. The U.S. went into Afghanistan. We stayed there for 20 years. We spent $1 trillion. We lost countless lives. And it broke this nation. We needed to get the hell out of there. We should be celebrating today. And the reason we're not celebrating is because the plight of the people who are left behind. The contractors, the people who work for us, the translators, interpreters, drivers, Afghani citizens who helped the United States. Shame on us. We should have gotten them out of there weeks ago. And the fact that some of them are fearful for their lives is unconscionable. We should do whatever we can. Back up 10 of those C-130 big military transport jets and load them up with people and get them the hell out of there. That's our responsibility. But as far as maintaining an army in military in Afghanistan to protect this shell of a country? No, we gave them 20 years. We gave them all that money. By the way, the president, what's his name? Ghani. Did you hear he left? He went to Russia. He left with like four cars and millions of dollars in cash, so much so they couldn't fit it all in the plane or whatever vehicle he got into, and he had to leave some of the cash behind at the airport. You know whose money that was, right? Certainly not the Afghanistan taxpayers. It's our money, just in case you were wondering. So, you know what? I give Joe Biden a lot of credit. Joe Biden is taking a lot of criticism because it turned out horrible. It's just terrible. And just think about what's going to happen to the women and the girls and the young boys. And anybody who dared or had a family member who dared help the Americans. It's heartbreaking. Thinking about their plight is terrible. But you know what? They had 20 years to take our resources and our help and do something with it. I read something today. Why didn't we arm and train the women? They should not be so helpless today. And then you have Clarissa Ward from CNN reporting in a black burqa, and she's talking to one of the Taliban guys, and she said, you know, will women be able to keep, you know, going to work, going to school, doing what they do? And he said, yeah. And dressing, they'll have to dress like me. He said, no, that's not good enough, because her face was uncovered. This is the dark ages they're returning to, and I feel horrible for them. There were 20 years that all this should have been figured out. 20 years. Here's a little bit of Joe Biden from today.
When I came into office, I inherited a deal that President Trump negotiated with the Taliban. Under his agreement, U.S. forces would be out of Afghanistan by May 1, 2021, just a little over 3 months after I took office.
Yeah.
U.S. forces had already drawn down during the Trump administration from roughly 15,500 American forces to 2,500 troops in country. And the Taliban was at its strongest militarily since 2001. The choice I had to make as your president was either to follow through on that agreement or be prepared to go back to fighting the Taliban in the middle of the spring fighting season. There would have been no ceasefire after May 1.
Right.
There was no agreement protecting our forces after May 1. There was no status quo of stability without American casualties after May 1. There was only a cold reality of either following through on the agreement to withdraw our forces or escalating the conflict and sending thousands more American troops back into combat in Afghanistan, lurching into the third decade of conflict.
Lurching.
I stand squarely behind my decision.
Squarely behind my decision.
After 20 years, I've learned the hard way that there was never a good time to withdraw U.S. forces. That's why we're still there.
There was never a good time to withdraw forces. but we should have done it long before this. And here's the thing. Today you had Trump, El Gordo, criticize. What did he say? Something like, Joe Biden needs to resign now. I think I have it. So it doesn't matter what his exact quote was. Let's just go back 1 month. 1 month to one of his Nuremberg rallies and hear what El Trumpo said about pulling out of Afghanistan. And in case you need an interpreter for this clip, and it runs 35 seconds, so I'm not going to assault your ears too badly. When he says, we started the ball rolling and they couldn't stop it, the they he's talking about is the Biden administration.
I started the process. All the troops are coming back home. They couldn't stop the process.
They couldn't stop the process.
21 years is enough, don't we think? 21 years. They couldn't stop the process.
Yeah.
They wanted to, but it was very tough to stop the process when other things are at. Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
It's a shame. 21 years by a government that wouldn't last. The only way they last is if we're there. What are we going to say? We'll stay for another 21 years, then we'll stay for another 50. The whole thing is ridiculous. So we're bringing our troops back home.
So he would have had us have them back home in May. It is now the middle of August. But so he blames Joe Biden for... Now, the thing is, Trump negotiated this agreement. Could Biden have gotten out of it? Probably. But the bottom line is, why? We needed to get the fuck out of there.
We plan for every contingency, but I always promise the American people that I will be straight with you. The truth is, this did unfold more quickly than we had anticipated.
You think?
So what's happened? Afghanistan political leaders gave up and fled the country.
Yes.
The Afghan military collapsed.
Yes.
Sometime without trying to fight.
Yes.
If anything, the developments of the past week reinforced that ending U.S. military involvement in Afghanistan now was the right decision. American troops cannot and should not be fighting in a war and dying in a war that Afghan forces are not willing to fight for themselves. We spent over $1 trillion.
$1 trillion.
We trained and equipped an Afghan military force of some 300,000 strong.
Yep.
Incredibly well equipped. A force larger in size than the militaries of many of our NATO allies. We gave them every tool they could need. We paid their salaries, provided for the maintenance of their Air Force, something the Taliban doesn't have. Taliban does not have an Air Force.
The Taliban doesn't have anything.
We provided close air support. We gave them every chance to determine their own future. We could not provide them was the will to fight for that future.
And the people did not have the will to fight for that future because nobody in the government instilled it in them. Ghani was a hack, as was Karzai before him. There hasn't been a stable government in Afghanistan, certainly in the 20 years that we occupied their nation, and we did occupy their nation. Everything. And then, so Trump comes in. Trump then says, oh, we got to be against the war, while he kept building it up. We'll talk to Spencer Ackerman about that, how Trump dealt with the war on terror. So-called war on terror, and how he built up our forces, and how he we did more bombing of Somalia while Trump was in office than ever before. More stuff like that we'll get to talk with him about. But some of the other stuff we're learning is, you know, Trump invited the Taliban to Camp David to further these negotiations once he already promised them that the U.S. would have a complete withdrawal by May. And then, but he cut the Afghan government completely out of the conversation and just started negotiating directly with the Taliban. That is opposite world. That is FUBAR. That is completely upside down. So if you're wondering why the Afghan people would not fight for their country, because they had no country left. They had no country left. Here's a little bit more of Joe Biden.
The events we're seeing now are sadly proof that no amount of military force would ever deliver a stable, united, secure Afghanistan, as known in history as the graveyard of empires. What's happening now could just as easily happen 5 years ago.
Yep.
Or 15 years in the future.
Yep.
You have to be honest. Our mission in Afghanistan has taken many missteps, made many missteps over the past two decades. I'm now the fourth American president to preside over war in Afghanistan. Two Democrats and two Republicans. I will not pass this responsibility on to a fifth president. I will not mislead the American people by claiming that just a little more time in Afghanistan will make all the difference. Nor will I shrink from my share of responsibility for where we are today and how we must move forward from here. I am president of the United States of America, and the buck stops with me.
Look, love him or hate him or somewhere in the middle, I haven't heard another president do that. Say, I own this. I'm keeping it. And yes, he's making excuses and he's blaming Trump, but he's also saying, I made this decision. The buck stops here. And perhaps not since Harry Truman originally said it has any other president said it. I don't know. And then he wrapped it up.
I made a commitment to the American people when I ran for president that I would bring America's military involvement in Afghanistan to an end. While it's been hard and messy, and yes, far from perfect, I've honored that commitment. More importantly, I made a commitment to the brave men and women who serve this nation that I wasn't going to ask them to continue to risk their lives in a military action that should have ended long ago. Our leaders did that in Vietnam when I got here as a young man. I will not do it in Afghanistan. I know my decision will be criticized, but I would rather take all that criticism than pass this decision on to another president of the United States,
good,
yet another one, a fifth one.
Wow.
Because it's the right one. It's the right decision for our people. The right one for our brave service members who risk their lives serving our nation. And it's the right one for America. Thank you. May God protect our troops, our diplomats, and all brave Americans serving in harm's way.
And good for him. Okay, obviously, his administration had a breakdown in intelligence. This was an intelligence failure. If they really believed that that the country would not fall to the Taliban in a matter of, you know, days, if not hours after we pulled out, then they were wrong. And yes, there was a communications and intelligence issue there. But I still give him more credit than anybody else. Now, I don't know what Spencer Ackerman is going to say. So let me tell you a little bit about the guest we have coming up. Spencer Ackerman has been covering national security issues for decades. He's one of the OG bloggers. He was doing this, I think, at Fire Dog Lake years ago, and he's worked everywhere. The New Republic, he's been at the Daily Beast for the last however long. I don't know how long it's been. Now he does his own thing. He has his own a Substack newsletter. Hello, doesn't everybody? His is called Forever Wars. So you go to foreverwars.substack.com and you'll get Spencer Ackerman's newsletter. A lot of it sort of goes hand in hand with the book. The book, Reign of Terror, How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump, just hit stores on Tuesday. I'm going to get Spencer Ackerman on the phone. Yes, he will be on the phone today. And although I want to play for you, yeah, I should wait till he's on the line to play this, actually. Let's give him a call and let's get him on the line. We're just doing it live because we can to show you this is live radio, everybody. So,
hello?
Hey, Spencer, it's Nicole Sandler calling.
Hi, Nicole.
How are you?
Pretty good. How are you?
hanging in there today. We are live on the air. I've been explaining to the listeners about the book, which I'm sure they've already heard about. It's called Reign of Terror, How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump. It just hit stores on Tuesday. And there's something to be said for timing, although I'm sure you would prefer that the events that happened over the weekend maybe not have happened the way they did.
Yeah, certainly. This isn't something anyone wants.
No, but to be sure, more precise, what's happening to the people left behind in Afghanistan is not what anybody wants. Getting us the hell out of Afghanistan is something a lot of people wanted, and something that under other circumstances we'd be celebrating, wouldn't
we? Indeed, and I think that what we are seeing is not an alternative to the war, which is how it is being constantly described. What we are seeing is the fruits of the war. The suffering of Afghans that we are seeing right now is the direct result of what has followed not only 20 years of futile, disastrous war, but the result of American destabilization of Afghanistan that went back to the 1980s as it aided the Afghan resistance to the Soviet occupation alongside the Pakistanis and the Saudis. And all of this history is getting flattened, and that risks repeating it.
All of this history is getting flattened, and that risks repeating it. So, you're saying this is far from over, right? There's still hostilities. There's still unsettled business. There's still the remnants of the so-called war on terror in Afghanistan. And we're not going to be free of that for some time, if ever.
That's not what I'm saying.
Okay.
That is true. What I'm saying is that the war itself is directly responsible for this carnage. We are talking about this carnage, the awful, disgusting images of people leaping to falling to certain death from Su-17s as they try and flee the war.
Yeah.
Try and flee the Taliban. Ugh. That is the result. That is the only enduring thing that what was once called Operation Enduring Freedom has yielded.
Right.
A human disaster.
Oh, my goodness.
What is happening, I think, in the discourse around this over the last several days, and in particular today, is the overwhelming desire to pretend that more war would ultimately reduce this circumstance instead of exacerbating it. And if we allow that to take root, then the next Afghanistan war is nigh, and it won't even necessarily be outside of Afghanistan. We heard President Biden say today that he reserves the right to drop bombs on Afghanistan as he sees fit. And that is deeply in keeping with the way the United States, for instance, withdrew from Iraq, only to ultimately, re-escalate because of perceived national security needs. And, to the point that you brought up earlier, it is very, very true that most of the architecture of the war on terror, the mass surveillance, immigration giving a counterterrorism sheen, indefinite detention, all of the other components, the existence of the Department of Homeland Security that was used against American citizens so vividly on the streets last summer, all of that remains in place. All of that remains unaddressed. All of that remains tools for the next authoritarian.
Oh, boy.
That's what my book is about.
Yeah, it is. We're going to get into the book in a moment. I just, I went looking to see. I didn't have time to read the whole book. I'm midway through it. It's a brilliant book, and it's intriguing and fascinating. But I went looking online to see what I could find of any interviews you've done about the book, just to get some insight. And I found something from almost 10 years ago. You didn't ask me anything, and you have one question posted. And it was, what would be the worst consequence of leaving Afghanistan? I'm sure you recall this, yes?
No, I have no idea.
Oh, my.
I do lots of these things.
Okay.
If you asked me what I did, 2 years ago, I would have no way of telling you.
Okay.
So what in the world did I say
on this?
Ask me anything 10 years ago.
Let's listen. Here we go. It's Ask Spencer Ackerman Anything. A reader asks, what do you foresee as the worst consequence of pulling out of Afghanistan?
The worst consequence of pulling out of Afghanistan is, from as best as I can tell, and I don't want to play fake Afghanistan expert, a problem for Afghanistan. Huh? It will be a problem for Afghans, which is to say the internal collapse of Afghanistan, built on shaky foundations, a ward of the international community economically, a fractured place politically, and increasingly unable to reconcile itself to a circumstance that seemingly most Afghans want, which is the end of 30 years of conflict. Institution building in Afghanistan is a failure. It's proven itself ultimately to be a folly. The administration has vacillated, I think, both in its internal deliberations and in its public presentations, between triaging a terrible situation and setting itself lofty goals for institutional building while telling both itself, Congress, and the public that it wasn't doing these things anymore. And this is an internal contradiction that the administration never fully resolved. The consequences of the last couple of years bear that out, and which Afghanistan itself may not be in a position to internally reconcile. One of the more terrifying prospects that I've heard from a good friend of mine who's lived in Afghanistan for the last two odd years is that even if the best case scenarios for the West pan out, which is to say the Taliban, the Karzai administration, the Pakistanis, and the United States manage to come to some kind of peace deal, the former U.S. allies in the Northern Alliance, the warlords who initially helped the U.S. Invade Afghanistan, take Kabul away from the Taliban, most of them non-Pashtuns, will find that circumstance absolutely unacceptable and will have a civil war even in the case of a Taliban-Karzai peace deal. That strikes me as, you know, probably a possibility worth considering and triaging. But from the perspective of what the U.S. can do to mitigate it, I'm not ultimately certain. It strikes me as foolhardy to say that once the U.S. leaves, Al-Qaeda will stream back into Afghanistan. There's no evidence that it's powerful enough to do so. There's also very little evidence that the Taliban find that to be such an important fact about their strategic situation that they would sacrifice a further chance at victory in the name of an alliance with Al-Qaeda that's ultimately been very costly for them. On the other hand, the Taliban right now probably have good reason to consider that they're winning.
There you go. So Spencer Ackerman, you kind of prescient, yeah?
Not all, you know, not all of that age as well, but I appreciate that.
There you go. So the book Reign of Terror is out, and you talk about the war on terror, and you begin with probably the worst case of domestic terrorism up until January 6th, I would qualify that, and the Oklahoma City bombing. Or maybe it was worse because more people died. I don't know. But you point to Oklahoma City and Timothy McVeigh as, you know, terrorism here, but you draw a distinction that America doesn't count white terrorism as terrorism as they do when they're foreigners or brown-skinned or Muslim.
Yeah, that's right. I think that in order to see what the war of terror, in order to see what the war on terror is and how it operates, it's important to look at what the exceptions are. And nowhere was that more visibly on display than in looking at the reaction to Oklahoma City and the way it spared the infrastructure of white terrorism in this country, the expansive persecution, the expansive decimation of, you know, constitutional protections around association and around the ability to essentially, you know, be secure in your papers and your effects. I'm kind of butchering the language of the Fourth Amendment, but nevertheless, when we see what happens when terrorism isn't white, we get things like the Patriot Act, we get things like the Department of Homeland Security, we get things like the NSA bulk collection programs for spying on Americans en masse. We get the essentially criminalization of immigration, the treatment of immigration as a national security threat rather than a mechanism for making more Americans. None of that. I'm not trying to suggest that there should be a war on terror against white extremists. I don't think there ought to be. I don't think, as much as I hate white supremacy and want to see all of its works destroyed, that a war on terror can possibly produce that. All a war on terror can do is recapitulate the circumstances that white terrorism uses to exploit people and turn them into followers. Everything that would happen here would seem in white supremacist propaganda to vindicate its narrative of persecution, its narrative that America has been internally subverted by non-white threats in order to persecute the true American. We shouldn't do any of that. I am bringing up the Oklahoma City bombings, and then I, you know, end the book with January 6th, in order to make that point about, first, the exceptionalism that occurs here. Secondly, the historical rootedness of that exceptionalism in American history. And thirdly, to show that while America fights a war on terror that, on the surface of it, is predicated on being agnostic to ideology, as the FBI likes to say, in my view, deceptively, we see instead that white terrorism grows in strength while a war on terror exists. And then when you get ultimately, as I argue in the book, you would inevitably, a figure like Trump is president, all of those mechanisms created for the war on terror can be repurposed against those citizens that nativists view as internal subversives, declaring Black Lives Matter to be a terrorist,
right,
declaring anti-fascism to be terrorism, treating it with investigations from a joint terrorism task force, treating it with rubber bullets from the Department of Homeland Security and the U.S. Marshals and so on.
So is that why you say, I mean, you don't like the whole concept of a war on terror? Because
you know, got that right.
It's the definition of terror. It's who they can proclaim as a terrorist.
Yes. The book is called Reign of Terror for a reason. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to get across that what happened after 9/11 under this veil of patriotic unreality was a reign of terror.
Right.
And real human beings suffered under it. Real human beings, people with names, people with souls, did not survive this. And while that happened, it always happened inside the United States. Huh. This isn't a case of a foreign war coming home. This is a case of a war that exists simultaneously at home and abroad.
Yes.
And some of its greatest excesses are beta tested first abroad and then find easy application inside a brittle America, an America that has, as a consequence of the war on terror, the institutions that are supposed to protect Americans and that are supposed to protect American freedom eroded.
Right.
A brittle America that tells itself it's resilient, a brittle America that basically lies in wait for a Donald Trump-like figure and then the next Trump.
So the Patriot Act and the other infringements on our freedoms that were put in place after 9/11, ostensibly to protect us, that's what you're talking about. We paid the price. Osama bin Laden, his goal was to destroy the American dream, basically, the American, not really exceptionalism, but perceived exceptionalism, the American way of life, wanted us to stop shopping, wanted us, our way of life, to be interrupted. On that front, he was successful because of all the stuff that happened to us here at home as a result.
I see it somewhat differently.
Okay.
Bin Laden wasn't trying to disrupt your way of life. He wasn't trying to stop you from shopping. He wasn't trying to stop me from, you know, going to Yankee Stadium.
Okay.
What he was trying to do was force the United States into a geopolitical retrenchment. Hmm. What he was trying to do, as he says in October of 2004, is bleed the United States into bankruptcy,
okay,
force it into a circumstance of overwhelming imperial overreach. George W. Bush provides him everything he would ever have wanted with the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan. And then Barack Obama takes the wars to Libya, to Syria. Bush also started out in Somalia. No one bombs Somalia more than Donald Trump does. Right. Trump comes extremely close to starting a war with Iran after assassinating Qasem Soleimani in January 2020. These are things that bin Laden wanted and succeeded at, but he doesn't get his actual goal. He doesn't get that real U.S. retrenchment. He means that much differently than is often interpreted by American scholars and foreign policy figures. What he means is the United States needs to be forced to abandon its support for people like the Saudi royal family, for the Egyptian military junta, and so on and so forth, the Pakistani government, and so on and so forth. Basically, what he wants to see is the end of leadership in the Muslim world that are allied with the United States of America. He doesn't succeed in that. He succeeds in getting the United States to do an absolute ton of violent, brutal, and counterproductive things, minting entire new enemies as he goes along. But, you know, bin Laden, I think it's too easy to say wins, because bin Laden ultimately is replaced by, you know, not literally bin Laden, but al-Qaeda in general, the thing that he brought out, is replaced by the so-called Islamic State.
Yeah.
Al-Qaeda loses a battle for global jihadist leadership. That's a story I also trace in Reign of Terror. I view Osama bin Laden as kind of, I know this is somewhat trollish, but if we were to map Osama bin Laden onto kind of other figures throughout world history, and we were to leave aside moral judgment, he, to me, is the Marquis de Lafayette, this impossibly wealthy person who becomes this symbol of global revolution, that sees himself as this figure of history. He goes abroad, Lafayette does, first to the American Revolution, bin Laden goes first to the anti-Soviet jihad in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. and then he becomes the self-styled leader of his own revolution. For a while, my friend Mike Duncan has a wonderful biography of Lafayette coming out next week called Hero of Two Worlds that everyone should read if they're interested in that kind of history. And there, what we know about Lafayette most conspicuously is that during the French Revolution, he loses control to more radical factions. That's what happens to Osama bin Laden. Bin Laden didn't fully live. Bin Laden didn't live to see that fully develop, mm-hmm. but all throughout, after 2004 in Iraq and the creation of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's al-Qaeda in Iraq, which is the, core that will become ISIS, bin Laden is desperately trying to get him reined in and focus him not on killing the scores and scores of Muslims that Zarqawi kills in Iraq, but focused entirely on the Americans, saying, like, look, we have a plan in place here. We have to attack the Americans in order to get what we really want, which is all of our home country's governments destabilized and overthrown.
Right.
And bin Laden doesn't win on that front.
Well, but he won on destabilizing America, because that did happen, right? And as you say, led to Donald Trump. How did 9/11 lead to Donald Trump? What is there a direct correlation between the two?
Yes, exactly one. What happens is that 9/11 in both respectable discourse and then in less respectable discourse gets understood outside of history and outside of material analysis, and only in terms of a kind of metaphysical explanation. Think of George W. Bush saying the terrorists hate our freedom.
Uh-huh.
There's a deliberate imprecision about who the enemy is. The term war on terror gets, all the more frustrating and euphemistic the more you pick at it.
Right.
What you have instead is this suggestion that what's really happening is a civilizational war, that this is a war, perhaps not with every Muslim, but with an enemy that's exclusively Islamic, that the United States is neither understands nor is particularly interested in understanding. Just by way of seeing the contrast, this isn't a war against al-Qaeda. It's not focused on that. That's deliberately done by the Bush administration in order to launder in all of these other kind of American exceptionalist wish lists, including particularly the invasion and occupation of Iraq. And so what happens as a result of that deliberate imprecision and that suggestion that this is a civilizational enemy is that the war on terror opens a door into the ugliest, most violent, most racist, and most nativist elements of American history, and allows it not just open, but to allow all those currents to race through to power under cover of a national emergency, a circumstance where we were constantly being told how afraid we needed to be because of the bomb that was always about to be let off. Now, that happens on a much more cultural level than does the transformation of the architecture of the American security apparatus and the creation of tools that provide for indefinite detention, mass surveillance, the spying on entire communities, including placing informants in houses of worship, and all of the things, the Department of Homeland Security,
right,
that go into the architecture of the war on terror, and then defended by people with political power, whether they're intelligence officials or elected politicians, under cover of enormous lies, big lies. The CIA doesn't torture people. It inflicts enhanced interrogation
on
them.
Right.
The CIA, under the Obama administration, isn't assassinating people with drone strikes. It's engaging in targeted killing and so on and so forth. The surveillance the NSA claims, performs, it claims, is targeted. In fact, it is the opposite of targeted. All of these lies get set into place to conceal the architecture and normalize the architecture of American national security that has been transformed in a manner that threatens freedom. In addition to people's lives, it threatens their freedom. And there's kind of no other way to view it. And then something extraordinary happens, which is that a global campaign that's predicated on reasserting American power becomes an absolute disaster, all while politicians of both parties that support it continue to lie and say it is not so much of a disaster. And then when they have a fallback position and kind of recognize that, okay, this thing or this thing or this thing is a disaster, they don't go for abolition and repeal and a return to the status quo ante. They trim at it under the sides, or under Obama, they wrap it in a rain of, in a belt of bureaucratic process and allow it to continue. And once all of that happens, you have ultimately a circumstance in which people who are sick of being lied to, but also really desirous of having this righteous, patriotic revenge, they're no longer able to trust their experts. They're no longer able to trust the elites that got them into these circumstances. And they're lying in wait for a demagogue like Trump to tell them that we don't win anymore and I alone can fix it. And I fix it by doing things that the establishment isn't prepared to do. And by not being prepared to do it shows how unfit they have been to run these wars that are just absolute disasters, but still reaffirming that the enemy in this war is not only civilizational, but still on the march.
Wow. Yeah, there's so much there. And I guess it wasn't only 9/11 and what happened there that led to Trump, but it was then, how the Bush administration played out and how the Obama administration ran for 8 years. They didn't necessarily back down on any of this. They kept promoting it. They kept moving it up. They did the surge. They didn't end the war, the so-called war on terror or any other war.
That's right. They made it less conspicuous.
Right.
And they entrenched it, particularly Obama. It's Obama
yeah.
who's elected on this tide of hopeful anti-war sentiment. But it's Obama who also entrenches all of these things and makes the forever war, like, really and truly forever. And I would just kind of add to that real quick that ultimately, unless all of this is removed, unless it's taken away, unless it's abolished, this is going to continue to destabilize America. Last night, Stephen Miller,
we know Stephen.
I think it's fair to, Stephen Miller, talking about Afghanistan, sends out a series of tweets telling people that Biden's real plan is to import hundreds of thousands of dangerous Afghans.
Oh my God.
And like, of course, these are people who are desperate to escape the Taliban.
Yeah.
And, you know, propaganda doesn't exactly get refuted with fact and with context. It works in a different way than truthful discourse does. But nevertheless, it's important to point out that Biden is doing no such thing, despite the fact that people like me would argue that the United States has an obligation
yes.
to throw open refugee
doors.
Admissions
yes,
and
please.
Let millions of people who are trying to save their lives and their children's lives into safe harbor in the United States, not just the few, you know, low numbers of thousands the Biden administration is seeking to take out because they worked for the Americans.
Right.
I would argue that taking out those, extracting those who worked for the United States in Afghanistan is a moral floor that's operating in the administration as a moral ceiling. And the administration is not challenging these politics. We heard Biden talk this afternoon defending the withdrawal. That's well and good. But listen also to what he said. One, he said that he continues, I think the actual quote was, we'll maintain a laser focus on our counterterrorism mission there and other parts of the world. So that
right.
shows you he does see the other aspects of the forever wars continuing, if somewhat inconspicuously. And what he didn't say is that they are going to let all of these people who are seeking desperately to get out of Afghanistan into the United States, where they will finally have the safe harbor that America is tutting to itself, that it's leaving them behind out of.
Right. But let me ask you this. We're running, getting close to the end of the hour, Spencer Ackerman. But, you know, Joe Biden was caught in this situation. He said, I will get us out of Afghanistan. We needed to get out of Afghanistan, this 20-year war that we've sunk lives and money into. Did he do the right thing here? He's getting a lot of criticism today. What are your thoughts on how he did it?
Well, he is definitely withdrawing U.S. troops from Afghanistan.
Right.
He was obligated to do that
right.
under the 2020 deal that he inherits from Trump, which I consider the only valorous act of a disgraceful presidency.
Mm-hmm.
The way I would put it is there has been for a very long time, deep antipathy and wafer thin support amongst the American public for these wars. Biden, to his credit, recognizes that.
Mm-hmm.
He is also influenced by it because as, you know, an experienced politician, he recognizes that there is a very angry constituency amongst a rising left within the Democratic Party that is looking toward abolition of the war on terror. He needs to kind of stay on its good side, at least. That's put him in positions where I give him credit for pursuing. But at the same time, he's not going nearly far enough if we're looking toward the abolition of the war on terror now that we recognize the deep, deep danger it poses to American democracy.
I hear you. And what about the people left behind? I know you want to swing open the doors, as do I. I feel for the women, the children, the young boys, just the people who want to move forward with their lives. And it looks like they've been pushed back, 50 years in overnight. Do we have any responsibility to them?
We absolutely do. We have a responsibility to resettle everyone who wants out of Afghanistan. We owe them reparations.
reparations.
The United States destabilized Afghanistan, not just in this war, but previously in the 1980s. If we want to have a hope of making this right, that comes with material obligations. We owe the Afghan people a life they can live.
I hear you.
That doesn't mean more war.
No.
That means mitigating the consequences of our war.
This is obviously too big a subject to cover in 30 minutes. The book deals with a lot of it, obviously not the events of the last, you know, couple of weeks and the last 24 hours, but this is the world. Reign of Terror, How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump by Spencer Ackerman. It's available now. And by the way, you can subscribe to Spencer's newsletter as well at foreverwars.substack.com. By the title of your newsletter, I'm guessing you don't think the wars are going to ever end. They will be forever.
No, I don't believe that. I don't think that we're doomed to be forever at war. What I mean by the title is that if we are not paying close attention to this and then acting accordingly, we will be in a very dangerous circumstance. And so accordingly, we need to have with precision and rigor tracking the permutations, the continuities, and the departures of the war on terror.
Okay. There's a lot to digest here. I suggest we read the book and then reconvene. Spencer Ackerman, thank you so much. I've been following you for years. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I really appreciate you joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for such a substantive interview, Nicole.
Oh, well, I appreciate it. Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye. There you have it, Spencer Ackerman. And that was a treat for me because I have been reading him and following him for a long time. He is one of those original, he's been doing this for a long, long time. We ran a little bit over, but that's to be expected, isn't it? Let me tell you what's happening tomorrow. You know, tomorrow's Tuesday. Gotta Laugh is supposed to be here because it's her week on. But she had a rough night last night. And she emailed me this morning and she said, I don't think I can make it. In parallel to discussions with Laffy and everybody else, a new listener to the show, a week or two ago said, how would you like to speak with somebody who performed at the original Woodstock? You know, right now, 52 years ago, this moment, Woodstock was going on. It was, August 15th, I want to say through the 18th. 15th through the 17th or 18th. Anyway, the person he's talking about is a friend of his, the singer Melanie. Remember Melanie? And actually, I thought I was sending Laffy a direct message on Twitter last night, and I asked her, "Do you remember Melanie? You know, lay down, candles in the or candles in the air, brand new key. Look what they done to my song, Ma." And so anyway, I just wrote that. Do you remember her? And I thought I was sending it just to Laffy. Well, it went out on Twitter regular, and people started responding. Yeah, I love Melanie. I remember her. Why? It's like, okay, well, she did a thing. Her son is also a musician. They did a recording last week of her Woodstock set. They recreated it song for song, recorded it, and put it up on the internet. And it's available for these 3 days for a donation or for whatever you want to pay. You can watch it for nothing, if that's what you can afford, or you can pay whatever you can afford. And it's up there. So she and I have been communicating via email. And here's the thing. She was all about peace. It was all about peace. And I thought, well, maybe if Laffy can't be here tomorrow, maybe Melanie can join us. So I think Melanie's going to join us tomorrow. We'll put time aside, like the first half hour, to talk. I want to take your calls because today all we heard from was David. So I want to get your calls on what Spencer Ackerman said, what you think, how we get past this, how do we move on knowing what we left behind. Do we have any responsibility to the people there? Spencer Ackerman thinks we owe reparations. Don't know. So we'll talk about it. And then we'll get an injection of songs of peace. How did the lay down go? We'll get to it tomorrow. Okay. Cause it is, we came to sing songs of peace. So I'll just throw that out there. Anyway. As I do lately, I will leave you with the news. Cause yes, there was lots of news made last night and over the weekend. So, With that, I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening, everyone. Bye.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Afghanistan is once again under Taliban control. The United States has spent 20 years there. We lost more than 2,400 troops in Afghanistan, along with around another 3,400 contractors. More than 20,000 Americans were injured, and that's on top of tens of thousands of Afghans who were killed and wounded. To add insult to injury, our two decades in Afghanistan cost the American taxpayers more than $1 trillion. President Biden said that the Afghan military, built and trained and financed to the tune of $80 billion by the U.S., should have been able to step up and defend themselves, but they just dissolved in a few days. Biden sent more troops back, it's 6,000 there now, to evacuate Americans and thousands of Afghan allies who are in danger from the resurgent Taliban. On Sunday, the Taliban took Kabul and the presidential palace. All commercial flights out of the main airport have stopped, and there are reports of violence there. Other countries are scrambling to get their citizens and personnel out of the country as well, and the U.S. has completely evacuated the embassy, the final act taking down the flag. Now, although the end came quickly, this whole situation follows a long U.S. troop drawdown in Afghanistan, which experts predicted would lead to a Taliban resurgence. President Biden is expected to brief the nation soon. Meanwhile, the former Oval Office occupant is the one who negotiated for the total withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan with the Taliban. He even wanted to bring Taliban officials to Camp David. Rather than defend his part in this mess, Trump released a statement that his press person tweeted out because he's still not allowed on Twitter. It read, quote, "It is time for Joe Biden to resign in disgrace. It shouldn't be a big deal because he wasn't elected legitimately in the first place." Oh, come on. You know, the RNC deleted an entire page from its website that touted Donald Trump's, quote, "historic peace agreement with Afghanistan." Silly Republicans. Don't they know the internet is forever? Someone should tell the orange one, too. As his statement from April 18th is still out there, it reads, quote, "I wish Joe Biden wouldn't use September 11th as the date to withdraw our troops from Afghanistan for two reasons. First, we can and should get out earlier. 19 years is enough. In fact, far too much and way too long. I made early withdrawal possible by already pulling much of our billions of dollars of equipment out and, more importantly, reducing our military presence to less than 2,000 troops from the 16,000 level that was there. Likewise in Iraq, and zero troops in Syria except for the area where we, in all caps, kept the oil." He continued, "Secondly, September 11th represents a very sad event and period for our country and should remain a day of reflection and remembrance honoring those great souls we lost." And then he finishes by saying, "Getting out of Afghanistan is a wonderful and positive thing to do. I plan to withdraw on May 1st, and we should keep as close to that schedule as possible." Just want to let that sink in for a second. Moving on to hell on earth. Yeah, I know it could describe Afghanistan right now, but it more accurately describes Haiti, where more than 1,300 people have died and thousands more are injured and missing after a 7.2 magnitude earthquake struck Haiti on Saturday. Hospitals are overwhelmed with patients. Roads are blocked, making it difficult to move medical supplies and personnel to where they're needed most. Tens of thousands of homes have been destroyed or damaged, making recovery even more difficult, if not impossible. Haiti was already in crisis before this earthquake, as it dealt with the assassination of its president last month, and of course, ongoing struggles with food insecurity, political instability, and then there's the pandemic. And now Grace threatens the island nation. Yep, Tropical Depression Grace is taking aim at the island of Hispaniola. Haiti shares it with Dominican Republic. The entire island is under a tropical storm watch. Grace is expected to bring heavy rains and flooding through Tuesday and could be a devastating complication after this weekend's earthquake. Now, Grace is only one of three tropical storms swirling around in the Atlantic off the East Coast. There's Tropical Depression 8 spinning near Bermuda, which will likely strengthen to Tropical Storm Henri in the next few days. And Tropical Storm Fred threatening Florida's panhandle with 50-mile-per-hour winds. Schools in the panhandle are closed. Landfall is expected sometime Monday afternoon or evening. Fred should bring dangerous storm surges, river flooding, and possible tornadoes when it reaches the coast. Fun times. By the way, speaking of schools in Florida, Ron DeSantis is doubling down, now pushing treatment of hospitalized COVID patients with monoclonal antibodies. The problem is, these treatments cost a lot of money. They're not simple to administer. And DeSantis is still banning mask mandates and any kind of vaccine passport in the state of Florida. And since he threatened to withhold funding for any school districts that mandate masks, the Biden administration has already said they'd make up for any lost funds. And it's not only Florida. In Texas, the all-Republican Supreme Court on Sunday temporarily revived the governor's ban on local mask mandates there, thwarting attempts by officials in Dallas and Bexar counties to implement COVID-19 restrictions as kids go back to school. The justices granted Abbott's request for an emergency stay that blocks lower court decisions allowing officials in those counties to require masks in schools or indoor spaces. The Delta variant is changing all the rules we learned from the initial COVID-19 outbreak. Hospitalizations for people in their 30s have reached a record high in the U.S. It's the latest evidence that the Delta variant poses big risks for younger age groups. Hospitalizations for children also hit record highs over the weekend. And finally, more relief for struggling families. The Biden administration is expected to announce sometime Monday the largest permanent increase to food assistance benefits in history. Under these new rules, which will take effect in October, average food stamp benefits will increase by more than 25% over pre-pandemic levels, rising by $36 to $121 monthly per person. All 42 million beneficiaries will receive an increase in benefits. And these changes don't need approval from Congress either. Unlike other new spending intended to help people through the pandemic, these added benefits are permanent. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack said the program provided a safety net and its $79 billion annual cost helps stabilize our democracy. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.